Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking with Eric Honer, DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, and our topic is American freedom. Eric, glad to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
When most people think about freedom, they assume that America's always had, many people anyway assume America's always had a single, unchanging view of freedom. In your book, which I might tell the reader I found incredibly fascinating, called The Story of American Freedom, you chronicle the ways in which that understanding has shifted through a variety of historical periods and circumstances. What I'd like us to do in the first part of the show is to look at some of those shifts historically, and it seems to me the best place to begin is with the American Revolution.
You know, the first point is, as you said, and as my book tries to argue, many different ideas of freedom have been coexisted, you might say, in American history. Different views have been prominent or predominant at different times. Freedom is not a single fixed idea. It's constantly changing and evolving, and much of its development is actually shaped by the struggles of those who feel themselves to be deprived of some aspect of freedom, to get the full access to the benefits of it. And their struggles to get freedom have actually changed what freedom means for everybody. The American Revolution is actually quite a good example of that. In the period before the Revolution, freedom or liberty, its sort of twin word, was certainly the most predominant rallying cry of the patriots. You know, there were liberty trees, liberty poles. We were fighting, the people fighting against British rules were fighting for their liberty against British efforts, quote-unquote, to enslave them. Now, liberty in that language was a political concept. It meant the right to self-government, the right to representation in government, that nobody could take away your property without the consent of your representatives. What's, of course, interesting, and this is not unknown at the moment, is that at the very time that Americans were proclaiming themselves the advocates of liberty, about 20% of the population of the 13 colonies were being held as slaves. The very people who were condemning British efforts to enslave them very often were themselves owners of slaves. So this contradiction between the language of liberty and the reality of large numbers of people being deprived of liberty was there right at the beginning of our, of our republic. It wasn't a secret. People like Jefferson, Patrick Henry, others agonized over this. And slaves themselves picked up the language of freedom, and in freedom petitions and in more direct action, like running away to the British during the Revolutionary War, they tried to seize freedom for themselves and give it a meaning different than what the sort of patriotic leaders gave it. To slaves, obviously, freedom meant more than just the right of political representation. It had a much more substantive and far-reaching meaning of personal liberty and emancipation, etc. But the Revolution, so there is this contradiction at the heart of the Revolution, but at the same time, the Revolution gave rise to a particular vision of the United States as a new nation, as a sort of worldwide embodiment of freedom. Before the Revolution, people talked about the rights of Englishmen, the rights of English common law, the liberties that came from being a member of the British Empire. After the Revolution, or during the Revolution, Americans talked of freedom as a universal entitlement, not something that came from being a member of a particular political system, but as a natural right of all mankind. And the role of the United States was to be the exemplar, the embodiment of liberty. This is what Tom Paine says in his great pamphlet, Common Sense. You know, the United freedom has been driven out of Europe, he says. It will be an America will be the asylum for freedom and for people from all over the world who are seeking freedom. And this, of course, has been a central part of the self-image, you might say, of the United States ever since. So the Revolution gives rise to this universalistic idea of freedom, that it's not something that is limited to the members of any particular group, any particular nationality, and yet at the same time, the very denial of freedom, which is built into our nation from the very beginning for slaves. So, you know, the Revolution sort of sets up both the exalted idea of freedom and the limitations of freedom, which will, that contradiction will play out all the way through the rest of American history.
You mentioned specifically slavery. Now, I do have another guest who's going to be talking about nothing but slavery, but I think it is worth mentioning, at least taking a couple of minutes here to elaborate on the themes you just you mentioned in your introduction about the role of slavery and how that served as a contradiction for the model of America as the haven of freedom.
Well, you know, freedom is one of those ideas that often is defined in relation to its opposite. And during American history, there have been many opposites of freedom. In the 20th century, Nazi Germany, or later the communist Soviet Union, were held to be the embodiment of lack of freedom, and our freedoms were held up and in some way defined in contradistinction to these oppositions. Slavery in the revolutionary period and then in the first part of the 19th century was the clearest example, obviously, at home, of the lack of freedom. Groups that felt themselves to be aggrieved in one way or another often picked up the language of slavery. Workers in the early industrial period spoke of themselves as being victims of wage slavery. In other words, they didn't just say, hey, well, our wages are too low or our working conditions are oppressive. We are wage slaves. Women, the early women's movement spoke of the slavery of sex. In other words, slavery became an all-purpose metaphor for lack of some element of freedom or other. On the other hand, of course, the abolitionist movement talked about slavery in its concrete reality, not just as a metaphor, but the struggle against slavery elevated to prominence in the idea of freedom the primacy of personal liberty. In other words, personal liberty was the greatest freedom. It was more important than, let us say, the right to representation. It was more important than the right to property. After all, slaves were property. They were legally property. But the abolitionists said, no, personal liberty is the greatest freedom, and the right of property does not entail the right to deprive another person of his personal freedom. So the struggle against slavery, as I said, elevates certain aspects of freedom to a higher plateau than they had enjoyed before, and in a sense makes less important these other elements which have been so prominent in the 18th century, like the right to be governed by your representatives. Well, white people were governed by their representatives, but abolitionists said, well, that doesn't make this a free country because you still have this concrete reality of African slavery or African-American slavery. So the battle over slavery is really the place in the 19th century where the meaning of freedom is most profoundly debated, and it shapes, you know, much of the course of that century.
All right. The other group which you mentioned earlier was women. Could you talk about the way in which the notion of freedom and slavery has played a role in the debate about women becoming part of the government, getting a vote,
yes,
and women's
indeed.
Freedom more generally?
Well, of course, you know, one of the things when I was writing my book that sort of surprised me was that how the women's movement came to play a more prominent part in this history of the idea of freedom than I had perhaps anticipated when I began working on it. Because, first of all, of course, women were deprived of some of the basic definitions of freedom that I mentioned. They did not have the right to representation, obviously, until they got the vote in the 20th century. Therefore, if you believe that a free government is one in which the laws are made by your representatives, well, women were deprived of that element of freedom. Women often didn't have the right to own property in their own name until well into the 19th century. Their husbands controlled their wages, their property owning, etc. They lacked that legal status of a free individual. But even more than that, the women's movement was demanding not just sort of the expansion of existing ideas of freedom to incorporate them, but it was putting forward other ideas of freedom which were rather different and rather new. The most important being personal freedom in the most intimate areas of life, the right to control over of your own person in terms of sexual behavior, in terms of marriage, in terms of childbearing, in all its incarnations from the early 19th century suffrage movement to later in the 20th century, the birth control movement to the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and later, this notion of control over your own body, so to speak, became a very important element of freedom in the language of the women's movement. And it has influenced how everybody, male or female, thinks about freedom today. Today, very often, we think of freedom as embodying this sort of right to control your own personal life, your sexual behavior, whether you are gay or straight, or whether you, you know, how you want to conduct yourself in these most intimate areas of life, that is part of our idea of freedom, is the product or is the contribution of the women's movement in American history. Thomas Jefferson and people like that weren't thinking of intimate personal relations when they talked about freedom. Freedom for them was a public possession. It was part of what it meant to be a citizen of a republic. The women's movement has extended over time freedom into the private realm of life and has insisted that there are, in those private relations, there can be elements of freedom or unfreedom or lack of equality or power. The rallying cry of the 1960s, much abused lately, the personal is political, was in a sense a statement that even personal life has political elements, that is, elements of power, elements of freedom or lack thereof. So this is a good example, as I say, of how our ideas of freedom change over time. This notion of personal freedom we have today really didn't exist at the time of the American Revolution.
But there's a clear connection, at least as I understand it, between the emphasis of freedom, the understanding of freedom, which abolitionists talk about. They moved away from talk about representation. They moved away from talking about owning personal property. They talked about, as you described it, the primacy of personal liberty. The women's movement expands that notion of personal liberty somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
The next change that you talk about in your book is, and it's certainly related to this, is the idea of civil liberties. And maybe that's it would be appropriate to talk about that a bit now.
Well, sure. Now, today, if you ask your man or a woman in the street what they think freedom is, they will have a lot of ideas, but pretty soon they will mention some basic elements of civil liberties, the First Amendment, even if they don't cite the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. These civil liberties, that is, that you have the right of self-expression in, and that the government cannot interfere with that, is today very central to our ideas of freedom. But it wasn't always that way. The Bill of Rights, which was added to the Constitution in 1791, was pretty dormant for a long, long time. It's only in the 20th century that the Bill of Rights really, that a jurisprudence, in other words, a legally enforceable set of doctrines to make sure that those rights really were applicable, came into being. Throughout much of American history, we have had a great deal of freedom of speech and freedom of the press, but they have coexisted with what today seem to be rather egregious repression of unpopular speech. Labor unions for much of our history couldn't distribute leaflets or couldn't picket without being arrested under court injunctions. Birth control advocates found themselves thrown in jail in the earlier part of this century for trying to distribute information to women about reproduction, basic scientific information. Communists, anarchists, socialists, people with dissenting ideas found it were rounded up at various points, were thrown in jail, criminal anarchy laws, sedition laws. So there were very clear boundaries of what was acceptable speech and what wasn't acceptable speech. And sort of the low point in civil liberties in our history probably came at World War I, when almost any criticism of the government was made illegal by the Sedition Act. People were thrown in jail for opposing the law. Hundreds, thousands of aliens who held radical views were deported. The government raided, radical organizations, banned their publications from the mails. And that, in a sense, produced a reaction and made civil liberties, for the first time, a central concern of a certain number of reformers. This is when the American Civil Liberties Union was created. And little by little, over time, the Supreme Court began to expand the right of liberty for dissenters. You know, freedom of speech doesn't mean that people who have mainstream ideas can speak them out freely. That's not freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is when the dissenter, the despised, the person who has unpopular views can get their views out. But little by little in the course of the century, those liberties expanded. One of the key moments, and this goes back to something I said before, was the period in the late 1930s, early 1940s, when the Roosevelt administration consciously made the Bill of Rights a central point of American freedom in contrast to Nazi Germany. this was one of the things that set us apart from our adversary as World War II was approaching. They didn't, you know, they suppressed violently, brutally any dissent. We allowed dissent. And in 1941, the 150th anniversary of the Bill of Rights ratification, there was a big celebration. The Roosevelt administration really made a big deal of this to highlight civil liberties as a central element of American freedom. If you look back 50 years before that, 1891, virtually nobody had even mentioned the centenary of the Bill of Rights. It was really not a part of public consciousness. So in the 20th century, civil liberties has expanded and become more, not that it's absolutely perfect today, but it's certainly much more deeply ingrained in our conceptions of freedom than it was, let's say, 100 years ago.
Well, now that's interesting, too. You mentioned the labor unions. In the midst of that, you're talking about the labor unions mm-hmm. wanting the right to assemble, wanting the right to speak, wanting the right to form labor unions themselves. And yet you also mentioned earlier that labor unions frequently talked about slave labor. So that in a sense, the labor movement tries to involve both elements that you've talked about.
It does. And then there's another. Labor also plays an important role in this because labor generally throughout our history is putting forward a different view on another element of freedom that we haven't really talked about much, which is what you might call economic freedom. I call this in my book the social conditions of freedom. What social and economic conditions are necessary for people to enjoy freedom, however you define freedom? There's been for much of American history, economic freedom by many people has been defined as sort of the free market, laissez-faire. Today you hear this a lot. You know, freedom is globalization, free trade, etc., no barriers to economic activity. This goes way back to the American Revolution, Adam Smith, etc. On the other hand, there's always been a different view of freedom, which says, no, economic freedom is not just the free flow of goods and labor, but it's economic security. It's making sure that everybody has at least some kind of base of economic wherewithal that will enable them to act on their desires and to try to pursue what they want in a free manner. President Roosevelt, many other people used to say, you know, the person who is poor is not truly free. So that freedom, economic freedom, has a sort of substantive element as well as just removing barriers to free intercourse of economic activity. And the labor movement has always put this forward in one way or another. In the 19th century, economic freedom often was associated with owning land. Jefferson, of course, you know, and many others said, if you don't own your own land, you're not truly free because you are dependent on someone else for your livelihood. In the 20th century, owning land is not exactly the way to, you know, make an economic living. There's hardly any farmers left. So this notion of freedom shifts toward economic security, toward a living wage. I mean, it's interesting, as I said, in the 19th century, the labor movement talks about wage slavery. In the 20th century, they talk about slave wages. It's not working for wages itself that's considered oppressive, but the level of wages, a living wage, an American standard of living. These phrases are very common in the 20th century. And what they say is that freedom requires some basic economic level that people have to achieve. Otherwise, they won't be able to really act as a free individual. Even today, you have these campaigns for, you know, a living wage or an American wage or things like that. So labor has been at the forefront of pushing a somewhat different idea of economic freedom, which is not just this sort of laissez-faire free market idea where labor is just considered another factor of production without any substantive rights of its own. Another example of how ideas of freedom have changed and been contested at many points in American history.
Well, now, let's expand a little bit on this idea of conservative freedom, which seems mm-hmm. to be so dominant today, which you just mentioned.
Well, in the last chapter of my book is called Conservative Freedom, and it's really about how in the last generation, a view of freedom which originated in the 1950s and 60s with conservative thinkers, and then with the Barry Goldwater movement, and then later on got into office with Ronald Reagan. That idea of freedom is very, very dominant in our language today. Freedom as lack of restraint. In other words, freedom as limited government, limited economic regulation, freedom as letting people do what they want to do, and freedom as personal responsibility. In other words, that the government shouldn't help out people at the bottom very much. It should make sure they land on their own feet and fight for themselves. Now, this is a very dominant idea, especially the libertarian aspect of it. Get the, you know, don't tread on me, get the government off my back, is very dominant today. If you go to the World Wide Web, the last thing I did when I was working on this book was go to the Internet and search for freedom in one of the search mechanisms, you will find anti-government groups, you will find anti-tax groups, anti-economic regulation groups, people who believe in the right to bear arms against the government. All these sort of anti-government individualist definitions of freedom are very... You won't find any pro-government websites that I ever noticed. But you'll find people who blow up government buildings or people in Montana who hole up in an armed camps and call themselves the free men. Now, that's an extreme version, of course. But this seems to be the most dominant view of freedom nowadays. And other ideas of freedom that I have mentioned, like freedom from want, which President Roosevelt talked about, or the freedom that the civil rights movement put forward. Remember, they call themselves the freedom movement, freedom as sort of social justice or empowerment for groups that have been oppressed throughout American history. Those ideas seem to be in eclipse right now. Whether this will remain the same in the next century is, I'm a historian, so I don't go in for predictions very much. But the one thing I'll say is that, as we've mentioned, ideas of freedom have changed so often in American history, it's hard to believe they won't change again many times. So what we have today is not necessarily the final word in Americans' definitions of freedom.
Would it be fair to say on this last point that part of the difference is there are two very different views about the role the government plays in human freedom? On the one view, the conservative view today, government is always the opponent of freedom. On a somewhat older view that's shown up at several points, as you've described today, government, in fact, is not only not the opponent of freedom, but actually necessary for freedom.
That's certainly a good point. I mean, Gary Wills just published a book about the history of American hostility to government, going back to the Revolution and tracing out how many different groups have condemned the government as the oppressor, as the enemy of freedom. It's a very strange thing, actually. We live in a democratic society. We pride ourselves on political democracy. We try to encourage other countries all around the world to move from authoritarian government to democracy. And yet, somehow, we, as soon as someone is elected into office, we don't view them as the representative of the people. We view them as the oppressor of the people. We view people in office as those who are trying to take away our freedom, even though we have elected them. It's not like they've come in by the divine right of kings or through a coup d'etat or something like that. So it's a strange contradiction in American life. But that view of government as the danger to freedom, the enemy of freedom, goes way back, but so does the alternative view, as you said, and there is this tension. Government as, in the words of Charles Sumner, the abolitionist, the custodian of freedom, that freedom requires power to protect it, that that active government can actually overturn obstacles to freedom. And generally in American history, now this is a blanket rule to which anyone can think of exceptions, but generally in American history, it's those groups who are lacking in power at the local level who look to government, strong government, for their freedom. African Americans, for example, have never feared the federal government. They think, you know, they fear the local governments. It's states and localities that have been so oppressive to them. They see the federal government as overriding local groups of who have been imposing white supremacy. Labor and others also who are disempowered at the local level have often looked to the federal government to protect their freedoms. So it's a constant tension, and the pendulum swings back and forth. There have been periods like the 1960s, like the 1930s, like the Civil War era, when the government actively expanded freedom for many, many Americans. And then there have been periods like we live in now, or the 1920s or others, where the government retrenched in the name of freedom also. And again, this tension will certainly continue in the 21st century, I have no doubt.
Well, given this change that you've talked about, I can imagine someone saying, "But doesn't it mean then that the whole idea of freedom is just empty? If it can change that easily?"
That's a perfectly legitimate question. I think freedom is an ambiguous concept, but it's not just an empty bottle into which anyone can pour anything they want. I think there are generally accepted parameters about what constitutes unfreedom. As I said before, freedom is often constituted against or constructed mentally against definitions of lack of freedom. But more important than that is, of course, as I say, there is no single meaning of freedom. It changes over time. But what unites our country, you might say, well, what then do Americans have in common? It's precisely that freedom is such a primary value for everyone. Freedom is more central to the political culture, the political language, the language of political discourse in this country than in other countries. Maybe this is not such a good idea. Maybe some issues are hard to translate into the language of freedom. Issues like race relations, issues like economic justice in other countries are spoken of as issues of equality or community or et cetera. But here they get translated into questions of freedom. But this very obsession with freedom as the primary, paramount value is indeed a source, oddly enough, of unity within American culture and American history. It means that all these competing groups and people are speaking within the same political language.
Okay, and so and part of what unifies it then is the idea that whatever political position you want to push, you better find a legitimate way of encapsulating it using the language.
You have to promote it in the name of freedom, and those groups that are able to, you might say, capture the idea of liberty or freedom find themselves in a very advantageous position. This was true of anti-slavery people at the time of the Civil War. It's true of conservatives since the 1970s. I have spoken on freedom at a number of, you know, various places, colleges, other places, and sometimes people say to me, well, maybe we should just give up this idea of freedom and find another lie. It's too ambiguous. People like certainty, you know. They like things that are absolutely fixed. It's too ambiguous, this notion of freedom. Well, I say to that, look, I think that it may be so in some abstract way, but it's really not possible. It seems like freedom is, we're stuck with it, for better or worse, as the primary value, and I think those who don't like what I consider myself a very constricted and almost inhumane definition of freedom, which seems dominant today, have to put forward alternative meanings of freedom. They can't just chuck out freedom altogether, you know. That's the challenge, I think, for those who think there are other meanings of freedom which are in eclipse today, is to put them forward in a coherent way as neglected elements of freedom. And, you know, so this debate is going to continue.
I know this is very short, but we've only got a little over a minute left. Uh-huh. Would you try to summarize your best understanding of freedom?
Well, personally, I am sympathetic to the notion of freedom, which goes back to the abolitionists and goes back to the progressive era and goes back to the New Deal, in which freedom is a constant process of individual growth. It's not just isolating yourself from others. It's not just saying, okay, the autonomous person who has no one else bothering them. I think it comes from interaction with others. It comes from, as I say, realizing your own potential. But it also requires that you have some basic economic wherewithal to be able to pursue freedom in this expanded way, and that the person who is struggling for a living, struggling to make ends meet, is poor, is, you know, lacks basic rights, is not genuinely free, and that if we really believe in freedom, we have to look at the bottom of our society and make sure that people there have the same potential for personal growth as those at the top who have all the affluence and advantages.
All right. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
I've been speaking today with Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.